us. Wedge closed his data pad and tucked it into a pocket, then casually turned his chair to face up at Thraken.
Yes, she's in the GA Armed Forces, as a lot of Corellians are, though I'm not sure where she is right now. I'm going to send her a message. I'd appreciate it if you'd include a note asking her to cooperate with what I suggest. And what are you going to suggest? That's not really your concern.
Wedge didn't even attempt a pretense at unconcern or amusement.
Of course it is. I'm supposed to endorse whatever you suggest to her, regardless of what it is?
Yes. It's your duty. I have to insist.
Go ahead.
Now Thraken's voice sounded confused.
What?
Go ahead. Insist. I'm interested in hearing this.
All right. General Antilles, acting as Chief of State and Minister of War for Corellia, I hereby order you to communicate with your daughter Sael and do your genuine best to persuade her to follow whatever course of action I recommend to her. Is that clear enough?
Absolutely.
And?
Go to hell. Leave my family out of things, Sal Solo.
I'm going to communicate with your daughter. I'll convince her to do what I say.
Go ahead.
Wedge shrugged.
You're not worried that I'll succeed?
You might succeed, but I won't be party to it.
There was no reply. A few seconds later, the light from Thraken's chamber, still spilling in a distorted rectangle across the main table below, switched off. Wedge walked toward the exit and disappeared out of sight below Thraken's chamber.
Wedge just got himself killed, Leia said.
Han nodded. He's too smart not to know that. It won't be soon, though. Thraken needs Wedge, for now.
Battle Carrier Dodana, orbiting Trallis.
Ensign Lysa Dunton and her Quarren wingmen rose toward the field, holding the atmosphere within Dodana's main belly hangar. With casual ease, they reduced velocity as they neared the glowing opening, popped up through the field to allow the air resistance to slow them down another crucial few kilometers per hour, and floated on repulsor lifts to their designated landing zone. Moments later, they raised their cockpits. Crew members rushing forward hung ladders in place, allowing them to exit their vehicles. Mechanics arrived, plugging in diagnostic units, beginning refueling.
Ensign Dutton!
The chief mechanic, a lean man with dark eyes, approached her with his diagnostic data pad in hand.
Can I speak to you for a moment?
Of course. She shook her hair out. You usually work with the X-Wing units, don't you?
Yes, Ensign, but everybody's being shifted around across train while we have some downtime. I put in a request to work on the E-5s today.
Sile eyed his data pad. Is there a problem with my interceptor?
Not exactly.
He moved close and lowered his voice so the rest of the crew couldn't make out his words.
Actually, I just wanted to bring you some greetings from home.
She gave him a sharp look.
Greetings from Raltir?
Greetings, he said, from Corellia. Perhaps we should talk somewhere private?
An hour later, Vibrosword Leader, a tall human with graying hair and features suggesting that he was an actor hired to play a squadron leader, leaned over the interrogation table toward Sile and asked,
"So you shot him?"
Beside him sat a human woman, dark-skinned, with big eyes that looked bright and uncritical enough to belong to someone much younger. Sile had never seen her before. Sile nodded.
"I still don't understand," the woman said. "Why did you shoot him?"
"He lunged for my blaster pistol," Sile said.
"Why did you have a blaster pistol?" Leader asked.
"So I could take him into custody."
"No," the woman said. "You took it out to take him into custody. Why did you have it in the first place?"
"I always do," Sile explained. "When I got old enough to begin dating, my father insisted that I carry one."
That was a small lie. Her father had insisted that she carry two.
"And you drew on him because he was trying to suborn you?" the woman continued.
Sile nodded.
"Do a few things for us," he said, meaning the Corellians.
The woman looked skeptical.
"Ensign Dutton, You're a very low-ranking officer and a carrier full of people who could do the GA more harm than you if they were turned. Why you? What makes you so vulnerable to this sort of attempt?
I'm... Sile looked at her, and then turned apologetic eyes toward Leader.
I'm Corellian.
He glanced toward his datapad.
Right. Born on Corellia, raised on Raltir.
No. Born on Corellia, raised on Corellia. The recruiting officer assumed and put down that I was raised on Raltir because I have Raltir citizenship, but I didn't get it the usual way. I bought it.
The woman said, What else in your record is incorrect?
Nothing, but Lysa Dunton, well, that isn't the name I was born with. I changed it, legally, at a court on Raltir that is known for being horribly disorganized. I knew it would take years for the records to reach the GA military. I changed it to avoid comparisons with my father, so I could achieve a reputation of my own.
What's your real, the woman checked herself, your original name?
Sile Antilles.
Both the woman and Leader blinked. The woman reacted first.
Corellian Antilles. You aren't by chance. He's my father.
And Ayella Antilles, your mother?
I'm surprised you know that name.
The woman nodded.
So the mechanic tries to persuade you to perform unspecified actions for the Corellian government?
Sile nodded.
And he threatened to do things to my family if I didn't comply.
Leader gave Sile a hard stare.
So you've just gotten your family killed. You refused. That agent's superiors will now begin the purge. Good going.
Sile settled back in her chair, putting a precious few more centimeters distance between herself and her squadron leader.
I hope not.
I'll tell you what, Leader said. We'll look into this. If you're lying, you get a dishonorable discharge and whatever criminal punishment you deserve. If you're telling the truth, things are much better. You get an honorable discharge and you can go home to Corellia and fly with your daddy's squadrons and give us a crack at you. Either way, this is the last day you'll wear the Galactic Alliance uniform. Dismissed.
Sile started to rise.
Sit, the woman said.
She turned to Leader.
You, be a good boy and go away.
Leader gaped at her.
You?
The woman smiled at him, showing teeth.
The correct response is, yes, ma'am.
Now go. Leader evaluated her expression, then hurriedly rose.
Yes, ma'am.
The woman waited until he was out of the interrogation room. She returned her attention to Sile.
Yes, we'll verify the details of your story. If they check out, you'll be returned to active service. But I doubt you'll be returned to Vibrosword Squadron. I suspect that it can be considered a hostile environment for you now.
I think you're right. The woman turned her attention to the datapad in front of her.
It says here that you were offered the chance to join a new squadron, handling the first deployment of the Aleph-class fighters. Is that correct?
Sile nodded.
I didn't want to, though. I've played around with the Aleph simulators. They've got plenty of speed, but they maneuver like big plugs of Duracrete.
And if your only options are to fly Alephs or work as a communications officer aboard a sensor ship?
Alephs sound great, ma'am. Spoken like a true Antilles.
The woman closed her datapad.
Lord City, Lord.
She was willowy, tall, with long black hair and a flowing ponytail. Ben saw her first from the cockpit of Jason's shuttle as the vehicle drifted down on repulsor lifts. The woman was merely a shadowy figure leaning, arms crossed against the hangar pit wall. She walked quickly to the ramp's base, her attention fixed on Jason, her hand extended toward the adult Jedi.
Jason,
she said.
It's good to see you.
Jason reached the bottom of the ramp and took her hand, but did not draw her into an embrace.
Nalani,
Jason said. When I heard that you were the Jedi assigned to the Lord's station, that you'd be the one meeting us, I was glad.
Really?
Glad to realize that you'd passed your trials and were fully vested as a Jedi Knight. Congratulations. Her smile faltered slightly.
Thank you.
She released her grip on his hand, and her attention finally turned to Ben.
And this must be Ben Skywalker.
Ben stood silent.
Nalani cast a worried glance at Jason.
Does he talk?
Ben's vocabulary suddenly returned.
You're being condescending,
Ben said. Absently, she ruffled his hair.
Certainly not. You just had me puzzled for a moment.
She returned her attention to Jason.
So what did you want to do first? Get settled in your quarters at the station?
Have you researched the matter I calmed you about? Jason asked. Ben fell into line behind them, furiously smoothing his hair.
Yes, and I found a contact who seems to know something about your tassels. A Dr. Hylan Rotham. Tactile writing and recording methods are her specialty.
Dr. Rotham's offices, also her quarters, were on the ground floor of a university building built of Duracrete bricks and false woods, then comfortably aged for a couple of centuries. The walls of the corridors and chambers were dark, either soothing or shadowy and threatening, depending on one's attitude toward such things, and so somber that it seemed to Ben that they could swallow all humor. He looked over to the table where Dr. Rotham sat with Jason and Nalani. Dr. Rotham was a human woman, tiny and ancient. She held Jason's mass of tassels up before her eyes, scrutinizing them from a distance of only 4 or 5 centimeters.
This one, Dr. Rotham said, is definitely Bith, a recording method of an isolated island race, the Alagar, that concocted the knotting style as a means of recording genealogies, strings of ancestors. Later, the technique was expanded to permit the recording of thoughts and statements. Roughly translated, it means, he will ruin those who deny justice.
Nalani frowned.
That's curiously ominous.
Why? Jason asked.
Yeah,
Ben said.
Jedi do that all the time. Ruin those who deny justice.
Nalani shook her head.
Ruination is sometimes a result of what we do, but it's not usually the goal. Ruination as a goal sounds like vengefulness, not a trait suited to a Jedi.
Ben caught Jason's eye, silently requesting confirmation of Nalani's assertion. Jason shrugged unhelpfully.
I'm certain I can translate many of the others, Dr. Rotham continued. Though, since they all appear to be separated from their cultural contexts, how accurate those translations will be is somewhat up in the air. Perhaps they provide a context for one another. If so, that will be helpful.
Jason nodded. I'd appreciate whatever you could tell us. He turned to Nalani and Ben, indicating the door. I get the impression that Dr. Rotham would like some time alone to complete any more translations. Ben, why don't you have a look around the spaceport while I update Nalani on the Corellian situation? Ben gave a reluctant shrug of agreement.
Coruscant.
It was like a replay of their first conference from days earlier, with Cal Omos, Admiral Pelion, and Admiral Nyathol occupying the same seats at the conference table when Luke was escorted into the chamber. They and their aides looked up as the Jedi Master entered and seated himself. Omos said,
I believe you have some news for us.
Luke said, As you probably saw in the report I forwarded, there's little doubt that Thrakken Sal Solo sabotaged the Toryaz Station conference, or at least, through his inaction, permitted it to be sabotaged. Omos's mouth turned downward.
Unfortunately, the difference between those two behaviors is the difference between the most serious sort of crime and a non-crime.
Non-crime? Luke looked appalled. You're joking.
No.
Omos, for this moment, looked like a man impervious to humor. Certainly not a generator of amusement.
Assuming that he did not pay for the information offered in the message he received, can you prove that he took the message seriously? That it was credible to him? Because he can always claim that he did not consider it a credible offer, that it was a communication from a crank, and therefore did not need to be acted on in any capacity.
Luke shook his head, unhappy to be thwarted by so negligible an obstacle. Still, if a strike team were able to capture him and bring him to Coruscant, a criminal trial based on the assumption that he did buy the information could drag on for months, or longer, keeping Sal Solo out of commission during all that time,
and that would be a boon to the peace process.
The others exchanged glances.
That,
Nyathol said,
is a far more pragmatic suggestion than I expected from a Jedi. I like it.
Luke leaned back.
Jedi are among the most pragmatic beings in the galaxy. We tend to operate under the assumption that it's better to get things done than to observe all the niceties. We consider justice to be more of a consequence than law, for instance. Even justice is often overrated. Sometimes the imposition of justice prevents redemption.
Pelion nodded.
Were you planning to remain on Coruscant, or return to Corellia and resume control of your squadron?
I was planning to return to Tralis.
We would appreciate it if you would stay here for a few days more, until we have a better sense of how the Jedi would best be posted during this crisis.
Luke nodded. As you wish.
Lord City, Lord.
Later that day, Ben stood behind Jason's chair, looking back and forth from the real tassels resting on a table, to a hologram of the tassels floating above. Dr. Rotham began her initial evaluation.
Number one, at the top, is from Fyrir, a dead world, its population scattered. The knotting technique was originally for recording, and in some superstitious cultures, magically influencing names. Its message, he will remake himself, or perhaps rename himself. The two concepts being identical in this context. Next is the one I translated for you earlier, from the Bith species, Alagar race. He will ruin those who deny justice. The scarlet and black one was easy, as it was the second of the tactile writing systems I learned, a recording technique used by the prisoners on Kessel. He will choose the fate of the weak.
Though Jason didn't move, Ben felt a jolt of emotion from him. Nalani must have felt it too. She gave Jason a curious look, but he did not acknowledge it. Keeping his attention on Dr. Rotham, the scholar seemed to be oblivious to the exchange.
I can't determine the meaning of the next one in the sequence. The poisonous-looking yellow and green one. After that comes a very tricky one. The red, yellow, and pale green tassel is actually a representation of a flower arrangement from the old Alderanian language of flowers. Imagine it as a bouquet in a vase, the red and yellow splotches constituting the petals, and the green the stems, and you get a sense of it. Its meaning is, he will choose how he will be loved. Actually, instead of he, it should be I, but I'm taking the liberty of assuming that the third person is to be used here, as it is everywhere else.
Speaking of which,
Nalani interrupted,
is it definitely he, or could it be also read as she throughout?
Dr. Rotham shook her head.
It isn't defined in all the tassels, but everywhere it is, it's distinctly he. Where was I? Oh, yes. After that, a very simple one. The gray and brown one is from a still extant Coruscanti subculture of indigenants, transients who pride themselves on being jobless, living by theft and begging. This three-dimensional representation of their language states, he will win and break his chains.
She continued.
He will shed his skin and choose a new skin. He will strengthen himself through sacrifice. He will crawl through his cloak. He will know brotherhood. He will make a pet. By which I don't mean he will tame some creature, but that he will somehow fabricate a pet.
Finally, Dr. Rotham's translations reached the end.
This one you already knew, Ryloth, Tahuip culture. He will strengthen himself through pain.
Jason nodded. That's all very helpful, Doctor. You skipped one. He stood and reached out to the hologram, his fingertips touching a tan tassel featuring jagged black lines.
Yes, I could not translate that one, though I've seen the recording method before. The zigzag patterns, the arrays of protruding claws and teeth.
Dr. Rotham looked uncertain.
In statuary and figurines from the world of Zyost.
This time it was Nalani who looked startled. Jason accepted the information with a simple nod. It means something like, he will be drawn from peace into conflict. Or maybe his life will be balanced between peace and conflict. The scholar gave him a curious look.
How do you know?
Believe it or not, I just feel it. The tassel's meaning is imbued within it in a fashion that only a force wielder can read.
I can't read it, Nalani said.
Jason shrugged. Maybe when you've broadened your range of force-related learning a bit.
What's Zyost?
Ben asked.
One of the worlds central to the origins of the Sith, Nalani said.
There's actually a substantial Sith influence to this collection of statements. Jason gestured at the hologram.
Several of them seem to be paraphrases of portions of the Sith Creed. The one about victory in chains, for instance. What we have here is an item fabricated by someone who is at least as familiar with Sith matters as a Jedi historian would be.
I hope it's only a historian, Dr. Rotham said. One last thing I can tell you is this. I brought in a bead crafter to look at these items, and he's certain that they were crafted by different hands. So you're not dealing with a single individual who's an expert in all these recording techniques. You're dealing with someone who has collected them, arranged for their assembly, rather than someone who has fabricated them all. Which is a considerable relief to me, because the alternative would be that I have an academic rival I've been unaware of all these decades.
She drew a hand over her brow, miming a gesture of relief. Jason gave her a smile. Doctor, your help has been invaluable, and we've asked you to do far too much work in far too short an amount of time. I do appreciate it. She beamed up at him.
I consider it my chance, so late in life, to offer some thanks to the Jedi for all they've done.
We'll leave you now, but if anything does occur to you about any of the tassels, any of the translations, don't hesitate to get a message to us. Jason wrapped the collection of tassels in a cloth and returned it to his belt pouch.
Good luck with your investigation, Jedi Solo.
Once the Jedi were in the corridor outside Dr. Rotham's quarters and headed toward Nalani's speeder, Jason asked, "So how was the rest of your day, Ben?"
"Oh, pretty good, I guess."
Ben struggled to look and feel nonchalant.
"I found the shuttle."
Jason smiled.
"Well, that couldn't have been too difficult. You were at the spaceport."
"Not your shuttle."
Jason frowned.
"Whose?" "The shuttle that escaped Tor-Yaz Station."
Jason almost stumbled, and Ben suppressed the urge to laugh. Jason said, "Wait, are you sure?" Ben nodded.
"The transponder code is a match, and so is the design. It's a Sentinel-class lander, with the weapon system stripped out."
"How did you find it?"
Nalani asked. Ben grimaced. This was going to be difficult to explain, to put into words. On the other hand, Nalani was a Jedi.
"I kept noticing when shuttles landed, they kind of drew my attention, even when transports and cargo ships didn't, which seemed weird at the time."
Nalani nodded.
"The Force was guiding you. You were open to it."
"I guess. And then I remembered something my mother says a lot. She says that any detail, no matter how small, could turn out to be important. And I remembered about the shuttle from Tor-Yaz Station. Mom's a spy, you know."
Nalani grinned.
"I know.
So I went through my datapad, all Jason's notes on details we haven't had time to go through, and I decided to see if the spaceport record showed anything about that shuttle. And there it was, parked half a kilometer from our shuttle."
"Who's it registered to?" Jason asked. Ben pulled out his datapad and opened it. He left all that information on the screen.
"A human woman named Brisha Sayo. She's from Kaminor. She wasn't at the shuttle. She just paid for a week's worth of hangar space.
She left no contact information. The spaceport authority thought she was staying aboard, but the ship's systems were all shut down. I told the guy who's in charge of security for the spaceport, Lieutenant Samran. He's got somebody watching it now.
Very good, Jason said. But what if this Brisha Sayo sneaks aboard and takes off when Samran's guard is snoozing?
Then the transmitter we stuck on top of the hull will tell us where she goes.
A comlink beeped. Jason and Nalani sighed and reached for their respective communication devices. But it was Ben's that had sounded. He pulled it out of his pouch.
Ben Skywalker here.
Really?
Did she put up a fight? All right. We'll be there in half an hour or so.
He sought Jason's face for confirmation, got a nod, and concluded.
Out. That was Lieutenant Samran. Brisha Sayo showed up.
The shuttle pilot?
Yeah, she's in custody.
Let's go. Jason led the dash for the speeder. The human woman sitting alone in the security interrogation room did not look like a criminal, at least on the surface. Clad in a purple jumpsuit that suggested both money and a preference for simplicity, she was about the same age as Ben's parents, at the height of vigorous middle age. She was lean, with well-defined muscles suggesting an active life, and had dark hair, slightly curled, cut short in an easy-to-maintain hairdo. Her features were fine, and she was attractive. Her beauty was very approachable. She looked like the sort of woman who had been a greeter in a shop or hotel in her youth, and still carried the mannerisms of that profession. The chamber she waited in featured a one-way reflective panel that showed her a mirrored surface, while the Jedi on the other side could look through it like a viewport. Ben had the unsettling feeling that she was restraining herself from looking at the Jedi, that at any moment she would look up and lock eyes with one of them, despite the physical impossibility of her seeing them. Ben knew better than to assume that her good looks and apparent friendliness meant she was a good person. His upbringing had grounded him in principles of both logic and the Force, and both disciplines knew that an attractive appearance could conceal malevolence. Still, he detected none in her. A Lord security guard led them into the interrogation chamber. Jason waited until the guard had exited, then sat and gestured for Nalani and Ben to do likewise. They took the chairs on the opposite side of the table from the woman.
"Hello," she said, her voice warm. "Jedi Solo, Jedi Din, young Skywalker."
"You know us," Jason said.
"Of course. I've been meddling in your business for some time."
"You admit it?"
"I admit to that, yes."
"What was your involvement with the events at Toriyaz Station?" Jason asked.
"I was there to observe you. I used my arts to stay out of the sight of the Jedi and the station's security forces. And I spied on you. Then, when everything went wrong, I decided that I needed to get out of the way until that mess was settled for the time being. I left something to lead you to me."
"The tassels?"
"Yes, of course."
"You were pretty confident that they would lead me to you."
She nodded.
"I knew one would speak to you and you alone. And from my own researches, I already knew that this collection of tassels would inevitably point to Dr. Rotham on Lord for decipherment. Any other so-called experts in the field would eventually refer you to her. So you'd be here sooner or later."
"You killed the security captain, Towler."
She shook her head.
"I saw him killed from a distance. A hooded figure spaced him through an airlock. Knowing that the Jedi investigations would lead to that airlock, I chose to leave the tassels there. Then I walked out of the Narsak habitat before security measures closed off the corridor to the main station."
"And you, coincidentally, ended up in the same shuttle by which the soldiers arrived at the station?"
"No coincidence. I used my own resources to track it down. Not tricky at all. Since I assumed it would go to the Corellia system. And there it was, hangared at the main Coronet City spaceport. I confronted its pilot, but he attacked me rather than answer questions, and I was forced to kill him. Which left me in possession of the shuttle."
"And then you came here, because you knew that the tassels would lead the Jedi who found them here to Lord."
She shook her head.
"Not the Jedi who found them. You.
You almost ended up with my sister running down their origin."
"I don't think so. In all the galaxy, Only you, Jason Solo, would be sufficiently intrigued to follow them all the way here and beyond.
Why me?
Because only you could read and understand one of the tassels. Only you could detect its significance. And so you'd demand to be the one who investigated it.
All right, Jason said. Let's put all this into some sort of context. Let's have your story from the start.
No, not here. I'll tell you at my home.
On Kaminor?
No, my true home. On a planetoid in a star system close to Bamiel. Not far from here, as galactic distances go. We could take your shuttle, or mine.
No thanks.
Then you're not getting any more answers.
Jason stood. Let's talk outside, he told Nalani and Ben, and left. They followed. Once in the corridor, he said, I'm going to visit her home. Nalani shook her head, not taking her eyes from Jason's.
Why?
I have to know how she spoke to me through the tassel, he said. Does she know something about me I don't know myself? Or is it a method she could use on other Jedi, perhaps to lure them into traps? I can't just ignore this or assume that imprisoning her would eliminate the risk she may represent.
But it's a trap,
Ben protested. Jason gave him a dismissive look.
A trap to do what? Well, kill you, I guess.
Why lure me out to some planetoid?
I don't know, and neither do you. Just because you can't figure out what she's up to doesn't mean it isn't bad.
Ben's right, Nalani said. The woman's story is too weird and complicated. Going to where she's the master of the environment is just a bad idea.
Nevertheless, I'm doing just that. Nalani frowned.
Then I'm going with you.
Jason shook his head. That's outside your jurisdiction.
I don't have a jurisdiction. I'm just assigned to live on Lord. It's fine for me to investigate something as near as Bamiel, especially when it involves the safety of another Jedi, and a mystery that involves the Sith world of Zyost. Do you think Master Skywalker would object to my going? I suspect he'd insist on it.
All right, Jason shrugged. I just think it's a bad idea for you to go.
Corellian system above Tralis.
Leia, led to the bridge of Dodona, marveled as she always did at the extravagant open spaces of a Star Destroyer-style command area. Admiral Tarla Limpan, flanked by the ubiquitous aides and advisors any top-ranking naval officer warranted, stepped forward energetically as Leia moved onto the bridge walkway. A female of the Duro species, she had pale gray-green skin and facial features that looked like a cartoonish simplification of a human's. Large red eyes without visible iris or pupil, an almost featureless mouth, and a broad, empty space where a nose should have been between them. She smiled and extended her long arms to seize Leia's hand between her own, shaking it enthusiastically.
Madame Organa Solo, she said. How should I address you, princess, senator, head of state?
Leia smiled, disarmed by the admiral's informal manner and energy.
Call me Leia. I am Tarla. I was informed you were in the Corellian system, keeping lines of communication open with the new Prime Minister, and a good thing it is.
She belatedly released Leia's hand.
To what do I owe the pleasure of this meeting? And I must add a certain sadness at seeing you arrive alone, by shuttle. Someday you might grace me by introducing me to your husband and his famous transport.
Of course.
But Han at the moment is out visiting old smuggler haunts, trying to get a sense of black market traffic and what it means to the current crisis.
That was a blatant lie, but one that anyone from either side would find difficult to disprove.
I'm here just to visit, in whatever minutes would be at your convenience. And perhaps to get a tour of your vessel. I haven't seen one of the new battle carriers up close.
It was another lie. She was here in the hope that by being in the right place at the right time, she might, however slightly, be able to improve the chances that her husband would survive the next few hours.
I shall be glad to oblige. Allow me to introduce you to my aide. I will volunteer him for the tour, and then you and I can chat.
Coronet Corellia.
Circuit trace routes?
The female voice sounded equally strong in both of Han's ears,
and was pure, true of tone. Han shook his head. It must be nice to own a vehicle where every component was brand new and flawless, like the YT-5100 Shriek-class bomber whose cockpit he occupied. On the other hand, something that new and shining lacked spirit. Millennium Falcon had spirit in abundance, memories ground into every surface. By comparison, this Shriek was a machine.
Circuit trace routes?
The voice said again. Its persistence jolted Han out of his reverie. He scanned the control boards ahead of him. 99.732, he said.
Atmospheric pressure?
Corellia sea level standard 1.0003, and zero variance from the pressure reading when we started the checklist.
Complete. You are ready to launch. Re-enabling comm lines to Panther 1.
There was the faintest of clicks, and then Han heard Wedge's voice.
Ready to launch?
Ready.
In truth, Han didn't feel entirely ready. He was at last beginning to question his role in this operation. Leia had questioned it days ago, become resigned to it, and supported Han in his decision ever since. Now her doubts had finally wandered into his brain. Was it the best idea for him to join this mission, having to train for it in secrecy? On the other hand, when had he ever decided against something just because it was a bad idea? Not in 40 years or so, and seldom before then. Doing things even though they were bad ideas had gotten him a decades-long friendship with a noble Wookiee, had landed him a wife no other woman in the galaxy could compare to, had gotten him beat up a lot.
Launch!
Han kicked the thrusters and put the Shriek into as steep an ascent as possible, going to a true vertical climb within 2 seconds. Through his forward viewport, the blue skies of Corellia gave way with a startlingly brief time to black space decorated with untwinkling stars.
Star system MZX-32905 near Bemeel.
On the view screen at maximum magnification, Brish's home was a hemispherical light gray bump, a blemish on an irregular dark gray surface. When Jason stepped the view screen down to a medium magnification, he could see the entirety of the asteroid as a dark shadow in the midst of a sea of stars. And beyond it, the tiny, dirty orange glow of this star system's sun, not far from the Bemeel system, whose fifth planet was notorious for its slash rat population, and for being the site of an early Yuuzhan Vong surveying expedition. Nalani, hovering over Jason's shoulder, stared at Brish's asteroid and said,
"Lovely."
Brish's face was reflected in the transperisteel of the forward viewport, and Jason saw her offer Nalani a smile that was just one step short of condescending.
"It's private," she said. "I like privacy."
Jason ignored them, and ignored the sensor readouts before him. Instead, he concentrated on sensing the Force. On that planetoid, there was something active within the Force, something strong and vibrant, but not alive.
"It's a big iron asteroid," Ben announced.
The docking bay was large enough to hold 4 shuttles, or the Millennium Falcon and 1 or 2 smaller craft. As Jason's shuttle settled into place into the berth nearest the doors into the habitat proper, the big bay doors slid into place laterally behind them. Jason felt himself settle deeper into his seat as the habitat's artificial gravity dialed up. He saw Brisha smile at him in the viewport reflection.
"All the answers you're looking for are inside," she said.
Jason nodded, which is not the same as saying everything we want is inside, or that we're safe inside.
"Correct,"
Brisha said. She rose. A flexible airlock corridor attached itself to their exterior hatch. Inside, the air was cold, but little eddies of warmth moved through it, evidence of the habitat's heaters beginning their business. The hallway, off-white and featureless on the inside, led them to a cross corridor in the same sky blue as the bay interior. Ben looked around, blinking.
"It's really clean. I thought this was a mining station."
Brisha shook her head.
"No. It was the administration habitat for the mining company. This place was more like a hotel than a mining camp.
In terms of design, it's like an early model Sinar mobile command post," Jason said.
but older. Maybe centuries older. At Brish's slight nod, he continued. It would have been assembled in space, near where it was to be set up originally. Tugs would have placed it on foundation columns built at its landing zone, but it was a valuable piece of equipment. When the operation was done, its foundation clamps would have released, and it would have been towed off to its next station, not left here. Brisha gave him an encouraging smile, then turned and led the way along the corridor.
Very true. No, the last administrator here arranged for the habitat to be left behind when the mining operation left this asteroid field. To be left behind and forgotten.
Jason quickened his pace to catch up to Brisha. That's a lot of arranging.
Yes, it is.
Brisha looked agreeable.
But the administrator who arranged it was capable of coming up with the bribes and persuading people to look away. He was, after all, a Sith.
Brisha brushed off further questions until they reached a turbo lift near the habitat's center and ridden it up 4 floors. It opened onto a circular chamber 20 meters across. The chamber itself could have been an extension of Dr. Rotham's quarters. Its walls were lined with shelving, and there were narrow catwalks along the shelving at 3-meter height intervals, with black metal staircases providing access between the catwalks. The shelves were thick with books, rolls of flimsy, flickering holograms, statuettes, kinetic art, and even, Jason saw, the bottled head of a Rodian. Its funnel-like snout pointed straight at the turbolift doors through which they'd entered. There was furniture at floor level, mostly long, dark sofas. The room fairly reeked of Force energy. Dark side energy. But as strong as it was, this was not the source of all the power. All the dark influence Jason had been detecting since their arrival. That lay below them, a long way down. As Jason stood in the turbolift doorway, taking in the sensations of Force power like a hungry man sampling scents in a restaurant, Nalani moved into the room's center, her hand on the hilt of the lightsaber at her belt.
So you are some sort of Sith?
Brisha shook her head and moved to stretch out on the nearest sofa, her back supported by one end. The sofa puffed up a little under her weight. She leaned back, her posture negligent, and stretched her arms above her head.
No, I'm a student. A student of the Force in all its aspects. And yes, I've concentrated on knowledge of the Sith. On utilizing their techniques without greed, without self-interest, to make things better the same way the best Jedi use the light side techniques. Then you've been corrupted,
Nalani said. Brisha sighed, exasperated, and crossed her arms before her.
What is corruption? A hard-line lightsider will say that any use of the Force for personal gain is corrupt. But someone who mixes altruism with self-interest in very human measures across a span of decades isn't corrupt. He or she is just behaving according to the nature of the species.
Jason moved over to stand before her.
Explain that. I'd love to, but first some context. This planetoid,
Brisha said,
was populated long before the miners came. A species of creature settled here. Desiccated bodies I've found in the deep places, and signs I've seen through the Force, indicate that they were akin to Minox, silicon-based, invertebrate, subsisting on stellar radiation and silicate materials. The ones here evolved or mutated into a sapient species, over how many millennia I can't speculate, and developed a society involving cultural hierarchies, stratification as we see in human cultures.
Jason nodded.
And the remnant Force energies I'm feeling originated with them. Yes. Their records, for they invented a form of record-keeping, a sort of information-imbued sculpture, some forms of which I've learned to translate.
One of the tassels? Jason asked.
Yes, one your expert probably couldn't read. These creatures' records indicate that at one point, a ruling class exiled a whole sub-society, sealing them within caves and caverns of this asteroid, cutting them off from the stellar energies that sustained them. They lived there, slowly dying of starvation, sustaining themselves poorly off the mineral content of the stones within the asteroid. And it was there that one of their number learned to detect and then manipulate the Force. That one eventually became leader of all the other exiles, then led them to break out of the asteroid interior and conquer the others. So why aren't all Minox now Force-wielding star travelers ruling the galaxy?
Nalani asked. Brisha shrugged.
I can only guess. In their writing, there's a reference for the home, this asteroid, plus mentions of the return, suggesting they could not spawn or divide, as the Minox do anywhere but here. If that's true, then they couldn't spread too far through the galaxy, and a fatal contagion or similar disaster here could wipe out the entire species within a matter of years. So they died out, and centuries or millennia later, an operation settled here to mine this asteroid belt.
I can guess some of the rest, Jason said. Prolonged exposure of the miners to a well of dark side energy led to weird incidents. People seeing things, Force sensitives manifesting odd abilities, perhaps channeling your Minox, behaving like them, and being considered insane.
Very good,
Brisha nodded.
The director of that time hushed up the reports, closed down that mine. The rest of the operation in these asteroids was unaffected, and kept things tightly under wraps. He too was a Force-sensitive, and had been experiencing things, experimenting, acquiring and testing new powers. When this asteroid belt eventually became less profitable as a mining operation, he closed it down. Carefully mismanaged things so that the habitat would be left here and forgotten. And then, leaving it behind, he went out into the galaxy, finding the Sith, apprenticing himself, eventually becoming the Sith Master, Darth Vectivus.
Never heard of him, Jason said. Brisha's expression showed a little impatience.
That's because he did no evil. He didn't attempt to conquer the galaxy, try to wipe out the population of a star system, or start an all-out war with the Jedi. He just existed, learned, died of old age surrounded by family and friends.
How did he keep from being ruled and ruined by greed? Jason asked.
Ah, that's easy. He developed a strong ethical code before he ever felt any pull from the dark side. The Sith who were famous for being bad, Jason, were the way they were because they were badly damaged men or women to start with, not because they were Sith. Usually they were weak or deluded or greedy to begin with. Like your grandfather. I knew him, you know.
Jason shook his head. How could I know? I don't know anything about you.
Conceited, I haven't been using my true name. It's inconvenient.
So you're saying that you didn't lure us here to kill us?
Correct.
And it wasn't because you're lonely or just wanted to show the place off? Brisha's smile turned genuine again.
No.
Then why?
Because down in the caverns, where the dark side power is greatest, there is a Sith Lord, and I didn't think I should face him alone.
Corellian space above Tralis.
Leia sat in the officer's mess with Admiral Impan, steaming cups of caff on the gleaming white table between them.
The GA tends to fall into the old trap of thinking of the Corellians as naughty children,
Leia said.
They're not. They're people who have never lost the pioneering spirit, even though their system has been well settled for millennia. Pioneering spirit, pioneering contempt for authority, pioneering disdain for complication or overanalysis. Think of them as children, and you inevitably forget how dangerous they...
A shrill alarm cut off her words. Uniformed officers at the surrounding table stood, as did Limpan and Leia.
Intrusion alert,
the Admiral said.
I'm needed. I'll stay with you if I may,
Leia said. The bridge was only a few dozen meters away, and when Limpan and Leia charged through the blast doors onto the elevated walkway, it was buzzing with activity. Officers shouted reports to one another, and a hologram of nearby space hung above the walkway. It showed the curved orbital line of distantly spaced Galactic Alliance ships and a formation of incoming craft in three groups. the fuzziness and blob-like nature of the formation informing Leia that its exact composition had not yet been determined by the sensors.
All vessels and ground control, go to battle stations. Launch all ready squadrons,
Limpan shouted.
Navigation, what's their course?
A male officer, also a Duros, in one of the pits below called up.
60-40 probability, Relidir or Blue Diver.
Starfighter control, route 1 squadron in 4 down toward Relidir, 2 in 4 toward Blue Diver. 1 in 4 remains with each launching ship.
The Admiral's head whipped around as she studied each station below the walkway.
Admiral, Leia said, I have some expertise with starfighter coordination, if I can be of any help.
Limpan nodded absently.
Back through the blast doors we came in, immediate right, that is, to the ship's port, first door. Tell Colonel Moyan to confirm your involvement with my aid, and thanks.
Sayo cursed as her Twi cleared the exit doors of Blue Diver Hangar and slowly began to accelerate. Grey One turned to lead the rest of the squadron down into the atmosphere. Sayo checked her navigation board, saw that their destination was a point due south of the city of Relidir. She nodded. The Corellians were coming to take their city back. She didn't know whether in her heart to wish them luck or not. Panther Flight, Han and Wedge, stayed well toward the rear of the Corellian formation. Han chafed. It was wrong to be at the rear of any formation. To make things more irritating, Han still hadn't heard from Leia. Admittedly, communication between them was going to be tricky and occasional. He glanced at the comm-equipped datapad that he had carefully glued to the Shriek control board once he'd been sealed into the vehicle. Its lit screen remained aggravatingly blank. Worse still, Wedge seemed to be reading his mind.
Don't get impatient, he said,
his voice so clear in Han's ears that he could have been sitting in the now-empty co-pilot seat.
We'll get there soon enough.
Impatient?
Han added an edge of disbelief to his voice.
Sonny, I'm just sitting here playing Sabacc with the droid brains.
Relidir Tralis.
This time Jaina spoke each word with brilliant individual clarity, making it impossible to misunderstand her.
I said, drop the shields. Over.
Negative on that. Negative.
The groundside officer's voice sounded young and a little panicky.
The enemy is less than 3 minutes away and descending rapidly.
Goodness,
Jaina said.
At 2 seconds to drop the shields and 2 to raise them again after we're outside, that gives you what? More than 2.5 minutes to dither and still be safe? Drop the carking shields and let us out.
She pounded a portion of her control boards, unoccupied by buttons or readouts, with her fist. Her squadron circled above downtown Relidir, confined by the energy shields defending that portion of the city. Other starfighters were buzzing beneath her, but none of the other squadrons seemed as anxious to leave the shielded area.
Orders are for all squadrons to stay close at hand and defend the center,
the anonymous officer said.
So you're to stay put.
Star System MZX-32905 near Bamil.
The three Jedi and Brisha rode the turbolift back down to the bottom level of the habitat.
That's something you could have mentioned from the beginning, Nalani said. There's a Sith in the basement. Any other home in the galaxy, that'd be the first thing out of someone's mouth.
What's his name?
Ben asked. Brisha shrugged.
He hasn't revealed himself to me, and so certainly hasn't told me his name.
Then she grinned, suddenly playful.
Darth something, I expect.
The turbolift thudded to a halt at the habitat's bottom level, the level by which they had originally entered the structure. Brisha led them from there through a side door into a hexagonal room, dominated by a tube. Tilted at a 45-degree angle, it was a cylinder of transparisteel, marked by a pair of metal rails. The tube was just under 2 meters in diameter, and suspended above it on a metal brace was a sort of metal-wheeled cart. The cart had 6 seats up front, a copious cargo area in the middle, and a backward-facing set of 6 seats at the very end. Ben peered at the tube. It led down past the floor into darkness, but as he watched, the interior surface of the tube began to glow.
This is going to be fun,
he said matter-of-factly.
Relidir Trollis.
Incoming fighters,
Gray One called out.
Coming in from orbit north, northwest.
Sile could see them on her sensors, big fuzzy blips resolving into two or three squadrons of starfighters and at least two larger targets.
We'll do this as a simple strafe,
Gray One continued.
Wait until they commit to a course, then follow me in. Punch a big hole through everything you see.
Star System MZX-32905 near Bemil.
The rail car plunged through blackness, and Ben felt his stomach rise into his throat, then break free and float, like a ghost away from his body. In the first moments, there was almost no wind in his face. Then, suddenly, the air currents increased and became cold. He guessed that they were now out of the tube and hurtling down through the caverns Brishan had spoken of. Ben could feel the concentrated dark side energy that waited below. It didn't feel so much malicious as merely ominous. Less an enemy threatening death than a somber realist reminding him that death was what he ultimately faced. The rail noises, suddenly close and echoing, then distant and quieter, told Ben that they'd passed through a narrow region and emerged into another cavern. He was grabbed by the collar from behind and yanked up out of his seat. He found himself floating, drifting through the darkness, perhaps hurtling at dangerous speeds towards sharp rock formations, and was so startled by the sudden transition that he didn't even cry out.
Relidir Trollis.
Incoming starfighters!
The voice of the leader of one of the two squadrons now escorting the Shriek bombers crackled in Han's ears.
You two stay put. We'll handle them.
One of the fighter squadrons broke away from the formation. The other stayed in array around the Shriek bombers. On the sensor board, Han could see the dozen attack fighters head out southeastward against the incoming flight of half a dozen starfighters, unknown type. Unknown type. Han frowned over that. He liked surprises, but only when he was springing them on someone else. The outbound attack fighter formation neared the enemy formation, and their lines blurred for a moment. Then, suddenly, there were 9 fighters instead of 12, frantically turning in the wake of the unknown enemy. The enemy still numbered 6.
Not good, Han said.
Lasers to power, Wedge answered.
Han checked his weapons board. The lasers in his topside turret were charged and ready to go. Half the remaining attack fighter escort broke away from the Shrieks and turned toward the incoming fighters, forming a defensive screen. Red laser flashes, missed shots by the incoming enemy, flashed by laterally ahead of Han's viewport. Suddenly, the 6 attack fighters that had just turned away became 4 on the sensors, and Han's targeting alarm shrieked with the news that one of the enemy had a weapons lock on him. Han kicked his thruster, then fired repulsors, tactics to vary his speed and throw off the aim of his enemies. He spun so that his shriek was presented edge-on to the enemy, dropped his own targeting brackets over the foremost enemy, and fired. The 2 informative sensor board responded with an almost comical ding, indicating that he'd hit his target. 6 enemy starfighters, oversized silver balls trailing narrowing twin thruster pods, flashed by from right to left, pursued by a flight of Carillion attack fighters. In the distance to the left, the enemy craft began a slow turn back toward the fight. Han blinked.
What the fear feck are those?
Cenar 11 class starfighters, Wedge said. They're out of prototype and in limited production.
Great. I hit mine with a good quad-length punch and it didn't even shudder.
Yeah, they're supposed to be like shooting solid metal ball bearings.
Wedge switched over to the squadron frequency.
Nebula flight. Panthers are making our break. Good luck. Panther 1, this is Nebula Leader. Blow something up for us.
Battle carrier Dodona above Trollis.
The starfighter control chamber was an exercise in controlled chaos. A sight familiar to Leia, who'd helped coordinate many starfighter skirmishes, starting with the Battle of Yavin. Aboard Dodona, they had bells and whistles she'd never enjoyed in the control room at Yavin. The entire battle was being reproduced via holograms over their heads. The skirmishes not exactly to scale, but with each individual starfighter or vessel shown in a wireframe form, color-coded to whichever side the fighting vehicle represented. The GA forces were blue, Corellian forces red. Unknowns, including several vehicles, probably civilian, above Relidir and heading away from the endangered city, in yellow. Equipped with a specialized datapad handed to her by the chamber's coordinator, a black-furred Bothan colonel by the name of Moyan, Leia could gather all sorts of data about the various forces. By pointing the datapad at